Hello, and welcome to The Coiled Spring, the podcast with potential. I'm Matthew Petty, your host, and I'm very pleased to welcome you to the first episode of this, my new podcast. What is this all about? Why am I doing this? Why are we here? And what will happen to me? These are questions that occur to all of us at one time or another, but I'm going to try and answer a couple of them now. Why am I doing this podcast? Well, I've had a regular written blog for several years, since 2003, in fact, and while I try and keep it up, it's often difficult to write a full post. And I'm not the best typist in the world, and I was considering, well, is it possible to perhaps transcribe stuff? And I was looking into technology for that. But then I started listening more to the podcast that I enjoy on the bus to work every morning. And I thought, well, that sounds like good fun. And let's give it a try. Why not? We've got some of the technology and it's all, you know, it should be some fun. So that's why I'm doing it. What can you expect? Well, the main thing is guests. I'm looking forward to talking to my friends, some of whom have got some really interesting hobbies and jobs, and some of whom are just really interesting and fun people to talk to. And so I'm looking forward to that.
Hi, I'm Kristen McGorry, and you're listening to The Coiled Spring. I meant it sounded a bit sexy there, didn't I?
You could do that, that's okay.
Hello, I'm here with my first guest of the show ever, of this inaugural season. We'll see how far it goes. And this is my first guest is Kristen McGorry, who is a very old friend of mine from Blighty, who's working over here in San Francisco at the moment, so I thought I'd take the opportunity to catch up with her in her hotel room, lock the door, and force her to record something with me.
Yeah,
I'm not allowed out. Hello, Kristen. What brings you over here?
Well, I'm actually here for work, so I'm in the very privileged position of getting to come to San Francisco quite a bit, which is great, because it's not like any other American city, so it's quite European, which is perfect, really. So it means I get all of the benefit of being in America without actually having to really be in America.
Which, let's face it, no.
No, we all love America.
Well, of course we do.
You've made it your home now.
I have indeed, yeah. And, you know, and I mean, that's what I'm trying to explore with this podcast, is the kind of fish out of water, stranger in a strange land theme. But,
Englishman in San Francisco.
An Englishman in San Francisco. Don't. And you've put Sting in my head now.
I'm sorry.
And I hate him. So,
I'm really sorry about that.
Yeah.
What have you got against Sting?
Sting is exhibit A. Well, no, just Sting. I think there's no explanation necessary. I mean, honestly.
Hey,
Stuart Copeland, on the other hand.
Well, yeah.
Prince among men.
Yeah. But, you know, Sting was in the Police and the Police were good.
Well, the Police were good and, yeah.
Well, he was part of that.
He was part of that.
Yeah, but I don't want to turn this into like a Sting is an amazing thing.
No, I know, but I'm just wanting to lay some ground rules here.
Like, what have you got against Sting?
Nothing. So let's move on. Accept it. Move on. Not carp and dwell. So yeah, basically, I think, and of course the listeners are wondering, who the hell is this person? So, well, they're wondering that about me as well.
Mm.
But let's start with, how do we know each other?
Well, we met about 12 years ago now. It's gone so fast.
Yeah.
That's scary.
Mm.
And we both sort of met because we were both very interested in what the Americans call community theatre.
Yes.
Or theatre. And we call amateur dramatics.
Amdram,
yes. Which is much more middle class.
Absolutely. The village hall.
Yes,
with Mrs. Braithwaite bringing the cupcakes or the sticky buns or whatever.
Yeah, well, I never got sticky buns.
Well, you always stormed off halfway through.
Oh,
so,
yeah, that's true. That's because I didn't get cast.
Oh, of course. Now it all comes out, you see. I mean, so, yeah, casting. I mean, Carlton, I mean, obviously was a very big part of both our lives, and still is to a certain extent for you, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I think I still, you know, obviously with travelling a lot for work and I sort of write a lot as well. So And I always, to be honest with acting, I always much prefer the intellectual process of rehearsing rather than the actual performing. And the performing part of it is a little bit of a letdown for me, because I'm not into the, oh my God, darling, you were so wonderful.
Right.
You were
me neither. Me neither.
Yeah. So it's much more about, in fact, one of the, do you remember one of the best things that we did, which I really, really enjoyed, was the rehearsed reading that we did of Liaison Dangereuse.
Yes.
And just because it was so much fun to kind of go through that whole process with everybody and direct it and be in it. And
because without the stress of having to learn your
lines. It's ideal. Yes. It's like a perfect thing. You get to sort of do a play and have the script.
Absolutely.
So, although we did learn one scene, I seem to remember.
Well, yeah. There was probably some grappling involved or something that had to be...
Was it grappling with Jane Lewis?
Oh, well, yes, maybe. Grappling with which side she's going to come on this time. Anyway, so... But that was good. I mean, that was 10 years ago.
Yeah. Wow.
We've done lots of stuff since, but you've written some stuff for the Carlton and...
I have.
But, you know, some adaptations, I suppose you'd say. What was the most recent one?
The most recent one was The Mask of the Red Death.
Which is a huge success, I gather.
Yeah, it was. I mean, I think, so there are a couple of things there. I think I was very lucky to do it, because the reason that it came about was that, because Carlton is brilliant, but they, obviously, if something is untried and untested, then it's a big risk to take for an amateur group to kind of put money behind.
Absolutely,
You know, because it's expensive.
Especially with a limited budget.
Yeah.
And it always seemed to me like that we were sort of staggering from one paycheck to the next kind of thing. Like
Hand to mouth,
exactly. You know, hoping you make enough money from one show to put on the next.
Yeah.
That can be a nasty position to be in.
Yeah, so I was sort of, I'd put forward a play, I'd put forward Accidental Death of an Anarchist, which is...
Say again?
Accidental Death of an Anarchist by Dario Fo, which is one of my favourite plays and I've always wanted to direct.
Yeah.
And it's a great play, but it's only got one female part. And so I had this grand idea of kind of rewriting it for the modern, the modern generation, and also kind of making some of the parts female. And
I think all media is... made better by having lots of women's parts in it.
Yeah, absolutely.
I've always said that.
You're a great fan.
And I'm not the only one
parts.
To have said it. I'm a huge fan. The bigger the better.
Yeah, yeah.
I think, you know.
Yeah, well, I wanted to put a couple of big women's parts in the Dario Fo. Unfortunately, the Dario Fo estate had different ideas.
Ah,
it won't let you change it at all.
Blasted estates.
Those
of
Italians.
Dead writers.
Yes.
He's dead, I don't know.
Yeah, he is, yeah.
When was it originally written?
I think it was written at the end of the 60s.
Oh, okay.
And there has been a more modern adaptation of it. I think they did a revival in like the 80s or set in the 80s. But yeah, so I couldn't get the rights. Well, I could get the rights to do it, but only... as that version
and
I wanted to do that. I wanted to rewrite it.
Yeah, exactly.
I wanted to take somebody else's brilliant work and essentially ruin it by rewriting it myself.
Make it your own, I think. Is the accepted term.
Make it my own.
Make it your own. Something that you did make your own from the very beginning, of course, was your original play, They Came From Woking.
Yes.
Now, what was that about?
So that had sort of two of my favourite things in, really, sort of sci-fi and Woking. Obviously, only one of those.
The destruction of Woking.
The destruction of Woking. Yes. Although I don't think we actually
got
the destruction bit, did we?
Well, no. I think there was a sound effect of the destruction of Woking, or at least the attempted destruction of Woking. What was the play about?
So it was based on the kind of films that, you know, the 1950s sci-fi films where something comes out of the desert, or aliens come down from outer space, and obviously they don't ever sort of have a full scale invasion. They do it by more insidious means, by taking over sort of the human form, and then basically just taking over the population that way, as anybody who's seen Invasion of the Body Snatchers.
Absolutely, yes, and invaders from from Mars as well. That's another classic. Like, you're not, you know, friendly daddy goes out and investigates, comes back, says, clean your room, son, and slaps him about the head. And it's like, daddy, why?
Yeah.
And he's, but that's a classic kind of gee whiz kid as well. So he deserved everything he got, in my opinion. But yeah, Invaders of Mars is a classic one. Of course, it's a themes of commie paranoia as well.
Yeah.
Do you think that
the enemy within?
The enemy within. Do you think there was a bit of playing on communist hysteria in Woking, or
no, not at all. It wasn't that deep.
I think in Woking, it's more fear of people outside of Woking.
Yeah.
Not from around here.
Yeah,
kind of thing.
Exactly. Anything north of Woking is very, very scary, dangerous place to be.
Although it's not as scary and dangerous as... Well, I
don't know. As Woking.
I wouldn't say dangerous, exactly. More sort of... more dangerous to your sanity, perhaps.
Mm. Mm. They Came from Woking was about what would happen if there was an alien invasion of Earth. And sort of basically an insurance salesman from Woking was the only person who knew the truth.
That's
And what would happen. And, of course, you played the insurance salesman in a part that I wrote especially for you.
Oh, that's very kind. Yes, I remember it well, and it was great. And I remember the scene where the insurance salesman, there's an event that happens, like they land, or there's a meteorite or something, and then he's getting all of these phone calls from around Woking of like, what's happened, like cars up in trees, and
yeah, and the cats.
And what's happened to the cats?
The woman whose cat's gone missing, and she's got because we had a thing in her shed, didn't she?
Oh, that's right.
You had to go around and investigate.
There was a special effect.
Yes.
We had a couple of special effects, not that many. Obviously, budget was a big thing, and time.
We had £10, didn't we?
I think we had £10, which we spent on, I don't know,
sweets,
and then had to scavenge. No, I remember I made an alien egg.
Yes.
From a bundle of bubble wrap,
mm-hmm.
rolled into a ball, and embedded in the bubble wrap was white flashing fairy lights to give a kind of stroboscopic, seizure-inducing alien egg effect.
Yeah, yeah.
And sound had a big thing as well. I mean, I put together some sound effects for that, which I'll probably demonstrate at this point in the recording. Wow, those were great, weren't they? And then also, of course, you say the aliens took over human form, but we did see the aliens in their true form, didn't we?
Basically, it was the classic, they were an insect form, and the whole reason that they were taking over the Earth was because they needed our sugar. So,
right, yes.
Yes, so we did see, I think we made like an alien ant out of a sponge, didn't we?
Oh, that was the mother.
When my character got taken over at the end by the aliens, then I kind of had to expel this alien through keeping it in my mouth in a sponge
and then going flobbing it on the floor.
Yeah, high level special effects. And do you remember as well that you made an alien costume? So your alien costume was the white.
Well, what was it? It was a white spray suit.
Yes.
With dealy boppers.
Yes.
Now our American listeners may not know what those were. Maybe had a different name. It was those kind of antenna looking things on springs that you put on your head. And these were in the little kind of like ping pong balls covered in glitter, on
silver
like
glitter. I
silver
think
glitter
remember.
On, and then the goggles were my favourite bit.
Yes,
because you took. I mean, I wrote a blog post about it back then, which I'll link to in the show notes. You take two plastic tea strainers, and then with using kind of wire and string and elastic and so on, you turn them into goggles.
Yeah,
and they give you that kind of bug-eyed effect while still being able to function. kind of in dim light.
In dim light, yeah.
Shuffling around
in blue light, I seem to remember.
Blue light, yes.
Yeah.
And they gave me the special effects. So that was a successful show as well. I mean, that came as part of a double bill with an improvisation show, wasn't it? I mean, you've done a lot of improvisation. Do you enjoy it?
Yeah, I love improv actually, because I think the great thing about improv is that it's actually it doesn't really matter how good you are, as long as when you really mess it up, you bring the audience along with you.
Of course, yeah.
So, you know, you can kind of get bad, obviously you can get bad improv.
Oh yes.
And we've seen quite a bit of bad improv.
Well, you'll know, of course, you'll remember that I was always the compare, because MC. I didn't actually like improv that much.
Exactly.
Not confident at it, really.
Yeah. But no, I mean, I love it, because I think it's just about, if you bring the audience on side, then they will, you know, they understand that you're making it up on the spot, and they're a lot more forgiving.
Yes.
In that situation.
So, and in fact, I've noticed that they really love, well, yes, that you get the warmest of applause and laughter and so on when a perceived screw up is rescued somehow or turned around. They love that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Even when it's faked, I've noticed, which is quite clever.
Yeah. And then you also, as obviously as well, the thing to do when you do improv is to find any opportunity to bring sex into it.
Absolutely.
Because that is the way...
Well, not so much sex as smut.
Yeah. No, you know, it's not sort of like full on...
No.
Well, although there was one time when Paul and I by the side of the stage, but...
Well, yes.
Yeah, but... Yeah.
Yeah.
But, yeah, any kind of opportunity to for smut or to reenact the Battle of Britain with the sort of, you know, two large-breasted women is just a bonus.
It is.
Yeah, I mean, my favourite game was always the one where you each got a word, so the audience would give you a word, and then every time you said your word, you had to either come on or leave.
Yes.
And that was the most fun one, and I remember the one that we did, which was... I don't know, because obviously you have to have you can't just go, I'm leaving now. So you have to have a proper excuse for leaving.
That's right.
However, we decided to set our one in death row in a prison.
Yes.
So it's not a lot of opportunity for a prisoner on death row
to the shops.
Yeah, exactly.
Just
that was
pop down to the chamber and like tighten the straps or something.
It was along those lines, yes. Episode 1.
I'm very excited about our next item because it's unique. I've really got the jump on everybody else in the whole podcasting and blogging world with this one. It's never been done anywhere on podcasts or on video or in writing. And that is, I'm going to be reviewing and sampling American snack products. Yeah, I know. It's you know, completely out of the box, I know. But anyway, yes, first I'll give you a bit of background why I'd like to do this. Being an Englishman living in California, I only moved here about 5 years ago. So I've been, you know, catching up on the local culture, but of course a lot of it you see, you know, you've seen as a child or living at home in England. And I remember as a child, sometimes if there was a jumble sale or a flea market, you could buy a bundle of comic books. And I'm not really a comic book type of person, or at least I wasn't, but you could buy a big cylindrical bundle of Marvel comic books, and I remember reading Fantastic Four and so on back then. And often, of course, in the back pages there'd be commercials, ads for Hostess snack cakes like Twinkies and cupcakes and so on, advertised by. I always remember Aquaman. There was a single page comic about Aquaman saving some undersea base by the judicial application of Grimfeld snack cakes. And so I was always curious about what these things were like. So I'm very pleased to be able to try them out now and give you some of my feedback from them, and to let my friends back in England know what it's all about. For my first Hostess snack cakes review, I'm going to be reviewing Hostess Ho-Hos. They're a chocolate cake rolled with a creamy filling. You get a little packet with the three of them in there. So let's see what they're like. Oh dear. Well, they're a bit squished. I'm sure that's not always the case. They have been rattling around in the bottom of my briefcase for a while. Now, my initial reaction is that these are very similar to the Cadbury's chocolate Swiss rolls that you get. So there's a sponge cake with a crispy chocolate shell. Well, not crispy, but, you know, like layered shell. And then a white creamy filling. So let's have a taste. Yep, and that's my initial reaction as well. Very similar to the Cadbury ones, with one key difference, and that is the Cadbury rolls are covered with chocolate, These, on the other hand, are covered with something that I do not know what it pretends to be. Chocolate-flavoured coating, I guess. Of course, Cadbury is always going to have that advantage with chocolate. However, they're tasty. The sponge has got that kind of industrial byproduct feel about it. It doesn't seem to be like a food product. The chocolate is, you know, chocolate flavoured coating, and then the cream filling is, well, it's got a bit of a crunchiness to it. I guess that's because of the chunky grains of raw sugar that's in there, or refined sugar, I should probably say. So in total, yeah, they're quite similar to Cadbury's mini rolls. But these have a hilarious name. Ho-Ho's. I don't know why they call them that. I guess it dates back to when they were invented. When they were invented is a key thing. I think a lot of these snack cake products are, as I say, industrial byproducts. And I think they're byproducts of the military-industrial complex of the second half of the 20th century. I'm sure I'll come up with some theories as the series goes on. So anyway, that's my first review of Hostess Ho-Ho's. I mean, there's two more here, I should probably point out. There's two more in the package, but I'm not going to eat them immediately. I might well put them away, have them with a cup of tea, perhaps for breakfast or something. But there you go. Hostess Ho-Ho's Snack Cakes. Thank you very much. The Coiled Spring,
Episode 1. You like horror, don't you?
That makes me sound like a bit of a monster.
Oh, I see what you did there.
Thanks, I know. I'm here all week.
You are.
I know. In this very room.
Yeah.
So, I'm a huge fan of horror. It's weird actually. So I suppose when I write, I like to do one of two things. I either like to make people laugh, or I like extremes of emotion. So if I can make sort of people laugh or sort of really terrify people, then that's what I like, and I like that feeling as well myself. So I'm a bit of a horror fan.
I mean, obviously there's so many different genres of horror. Would you say you had a favourite?
Yeah, I mean, probably, I'm not a huge fan of the kind of what you term now torture porn.
Right, like the Hostel.
Like Hostel. I mean, I do love Hostel, the first Hostel.
Yeah. Because it was so kind of raw and original, I suppose.
Yeah.
What was it? I don't know.
Well, it was, because in a way, you know, one of the things... There's horror conventions, and obviously the film Scream did a really good job of turning those on their heads.
Yes.
But the thing that I loved about Hostel is that this idea of the people did the things that you would hope you would do in those situations. It's like, how many times have you shouted at the screen, why are you splitting up? Why are you going into the woods on your own?
Yes.
Oh, yes, it is an axe murderer.
Right,
ending
yeah,
your death.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah. People, that's the thing with horror films, is that when people act in a way that you expect is when you can kind of get caught up in their story and identify with them and care about what happens to them, rather than thinking, well, you're an idiot, I want you to die as quickly as possible.
Talking about realistic reactions, I was talking to, I commented on a friend's blog today. Steph, if you're listening, everyone go and visit Steph Aside at blogspot.blogspot.com, which is a great review blog about, 30 years of pop culture that she's catching up on, I think, is the way it's being described. And she did a post recently about An American Werewolf in London.
Oh,
one
classic.
Of my favourite films. And I just always remember that there's a, apart from all the horror moments and stuff, there's a great line, or there's a great delivery of a line. When they're out on the moors at the beginning, and they hear the howl, and I think it's Jack says, "Oh shit, David, what is that?" And that's such a realistic. You can almost feel his stomach sinking through him.
Yeah.
Like, oh my god, we're out here, and that's out there. So I mean, so you're not a fan of the torture porn thing? What
no.
would you say?
So I like. I'm a huge fan of Japanese horror, because I think the thing that they do really well, that American horror. Is a bit less subtle.
Mm.
So, you know, American horror is very much that it has to be visually horrific for an audience to sort of react. They want that. You know, it's kind of the way that they've gone with things like when they've remade the Japanese horror.
Yes.
You know, you have to see everything, otherwise it's like they think the audience won't get it.
Yeah.
Whereas if you have that slow, creeping, building tension,
yes.
it's actually much like take paranormal, I mean, Paranormal Activity is a great example of the Americans doing a good job of that.
Okay.
Is you've got a film where essentially nothing happens for an hour and a half, but you know that something is happening.
Now you can always tell it's that kind of film because in the trailers for it or the ads for it, they show you night vision audience reaction shots in the movie theatre. People like huddled up and throwing popcorn everywhere. when whatever happens finally happens.
Yeah,
that's that. I've not seen any of those actually. I don't like being frightened.
Oh, you big wuss.
Oh, I know. But then there's the like the Italian.
Is that Dario Argento?
Dario Argento stuff. Mario Fulci. Is it Mario Fulci? Leo Fulci.
Yeah.
Luigi Vicotti. No, he was a Monty Python character. of course, with the Olympics just having happened in the in good old London town, I think it was the Russian synchronized swimmers did their thing to the theme from Dario Argento's Suspiria.
Really?
Played by the Goblin, the famous prog rock band.
Wow, yeah. I didn't know that.
And there was lots
really
of comments on it. And people, I mean, I don't know whether they won any medals for it, but there were lots of comments like, oh my God, it's the music from Suspiria. And it's kind of like this cyclic kind of psychedelic, I think it's kind of like got music box. Ding, 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 ding.
Right, because the music boxes are inherently scary.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it's like small children singing in Latin.
Oh my God.
Or fairy, singing nursery rhymes as well. That's another guaranteed horror.
Yeah. I was talking to someone who I think he married a Japanese woman, and he was saying he was hoping that when he had kids they weren't female twins, because then he'd be walking through his own house and he'd suddenly be confronted by his two little girls. Ah, Jesus Christ.
Yeah,
you know, daddy. Yeah, that would be the most terrifying children ever.
It would be the most terrifying.
Daddy, children. Come and play with us.
Yeah, forever and ever and ever.
But this is twins, though. Twins is just scary.
Twins is quite creepy.
So twins singing in Latin, nursery rhymes.
Yeah,
in
children
Latin.
Singing. No, so any kind of singing in Latin is obviously, you know, dedimus. And then sort of children, sort of, you know.
And then the music box in the background.
Music box, that's definitely.
Slightly discordant.
Yeah.
Actually detuned a little bit.
Yeah.
Any
film really that where you've got a child in. And it's interesting as well because like, yeah, they're always evil.
What you mean, like My Girl?
Yeah. Have you seen that film? That is pretty. Macaulay Culkin is pretty evil in that.
Yeah. Although, wasn't that. Who was the girl in that? Anna Chomsky, who's now in Veep and stuff.
Yes!
And I have major hearts
for
her. It is.
Of course, yes!
And she died at the end of a bee sting. Not on Veep. That would be stupid.
Yeah, that would be a bit weird. Yeah. And you'd be spoiling the whole series for us as well.
That's
if you...
true.
Spoiler alert!
Spoiler alert! Anna Chomsky doesn't die of a bee sting in Veep.
In Veep. Okay, good. I'm glad you clarified
I'm probably
that.
Pronouncing her name wrong as well, which is a shame, because I really do... fancy a plot. So yeah, in terms of genres, then there's the Japanese suspenseful, very stylistic, stylized, atmospheric, and then you've got the torture porn stuff. I mean,
and then you've got your kind of your classic ghost stories. I mean, one of the things that I really like those sort of anthology horror.
So
portmanteau horror.
Hammer did a lot of those in the 70s.
Exactly. So you've essentially got. That you've got five or six people or four people who come to this location, and
or they're in a train carriage, or
they're a train carriage, or they each steal something from an antique shop, and it's their sort of their story.
Peter Cushing owns the antique shop,
or is the train
conductor or something.
Yeah, in fact, never go if you ever saw Peter Cushing either in a shop or on a train. Then basically, you're dead.
That's true.
You're already dead.
There's so many rules in horror, though. I mean, I think it's not fair. I mean, there's always something that's going to get you. And then, of course, you've got the final girl theory.
Mm-hmm.
Yes,
which I'll see Cabin Fever. Cabin Fever. Have you seen...
Did that subvert the trope?
So that was another one of these knowing nod to horror films. I mean, that was a horror film buff's wet dream, that film.
Do you mean cabin fever or do you mean the cabin in the woods?
Sorry, the cabin in the woods.
Because cabin fever was the one where she shaved her legs off.
That's, yes, yeah. That's it. Eli Roth. Eli Roth.
Eli Roth. Of course, yes. The torch porn guy.
Yes.
And the bear Jew.
Yes. Yes, anyway, Cabin in the Woods.
Cabin in the Woods, yes. I haven't seen it. Don't spoil it for me.
Okay.
But I know
they all
that
die at the end. They don't.
But I know that it's some kind of experiment or something. And I don't, yeah. But yeah, okay.
I won't tell you anymore. I won't spoil it for anybody that's not seen it. But yeah, I mean, it's those, that's the thing. That horror is a very formulaic genre.
Yes.
And that is kind of its appeal, but also its limitations. Because you do have, you do end up having these ridiculous situations whereby people sort of, they do go, the best thing we could do now is split up so we can cover more ground.
Yes.
Or, you know, what's that sort of thing glinting in the woods? Oh, it is an axe murderer! You know, it's that kind of thing. Yeah, and the audience, so there's a certain, I suppose there's a certain sort of joy in sitting there knowing that something is going to happen, and that's why they set these films up in that way, these sort of situations in that way where you know as an audience member that something terrible is about to happen to them.
Yes.
But equally so, it's quite frustrating because you just want them to not behave in that way.
And, right, right.
Yeah.
I mean, have you ever seen the film, now what is it called? I cannot remember. But it's basically a serial killer film about a guy who's being followed by a film crew on his serial killing.
Oh,
not man bites dog.
Mm.
But it's like a kind of an American slasher thing. He wears like a sackcloth mask, and the film crew follows him on his rampages.
Mm.
And then at one point, Robert Englund turns up in the kind of role that Donald Pleasance plays in Halloween.
Right.
And he, luckily, our anti-hero escapes, but he's really pleased because now he's got and he uses the character name from Donald Pleasance's character name from Halloween, which is whatever, Doctor Something.
Mm.
I've got a Doctor So and So. It means I'm doing well in my job as a serial killer. This nemesis is after me, and then there's the final girl, and it all kind of comes together. Obviously, you wrote The Mask of the Red Death.
Yes.
Have we talked about that already? I don't know if we have.
No, not so far. No.
Okay.
Yeah. So I mean, the Mask of the Red Death was my kind of nod to those kind of portmanteau horror. Using as very loosely the stories of Edgar Allan Poe.
Yes.
So the idea is that a group of four strangers are sent a party invitation which says come and play.
Okay.
Which I then found out was a strapline that in the Night Garden uses. So either I'm some kind of sick thing, or in the Night Garden with what's his name? I don't have children, so Iggle Piggle.
Iggle Piggle?
Yeah,
what?
It's some British TV programme that children love. It's aimed at children, and it's quite disturbing, actually. Look up Iggle Piggle.
Okay.
Yeah.
I haven't seen The Night Garden or read it.
It was come and play, and they turn up, and then they each tell their stories to this to this kind of Machiavellian sort of character, whose name was Mr. Reese.
Mr. Reese. Oh, not the chocolate guy.
Yeah. No.
Can't have peanut butter cups, everyone.
Yeah, which is my nod to Angel Heart, because obviously the character in Angel Heart is Lewis Cypher. And I remember seeing that film and going, Lewis Cypher, well, that's Lucifer. And then when it said at the end, oh, it's Lucifer, the whole audience went, I was like, this is the worst pun ever.
Like Dr. Dracula.
Yes.
Portmanteau horror, though. I mean, I've seen, there was one I saw at the National Film Theatre, I think, Dead of Night, which is a British one from the 40s.
Absolutely brilliant.
It's patchy. And, of course, the worst patch of all is the one where it's two, apparently, vaudeville comedy stars playing golf against each other over a woman, and then one of them commits suicide at the end because, oh, I say, you won fair and square, old boy, I'm going to walk into the water trap on the fifth now, and he walks in, and it's like, I don't care who these people are. Maybe it was interesting to people who'd seen them in the 40s. I don't know. Anyway, that was a big patch for me. But a lot of it was great.
Yeah, but it's I think the really good thing about Dead of Night is it's very atmospheric.
Yeah.
And you know, there's the great one with the family in the house, the children in the house, and
yes,
and the birthday party. Yeah, and then there's a, you know, there's obviously the I can't remember the name of the one that's got Donald Pleasance in. And again,
another portmanteau horror.
Yeah. And David Warner's got a mirror which makes him go out and kill people.
Oh yes,
which is the antique shop one.
The antique shop one. Now David Warner, of course, is one of my favourite actors, and yes. I have a list. So David Warner, Harry Dean Stanton,
mm-hmm.
Brad Dourif.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I know you love Brad.
I know I love Brad. more for his work in, I mean, yes, Oscar nominated, whatever, but like Critters 4.
Yeah, what I found with The Mask of the Red Death is that it allows you to have lots of different stories to tell.
Yeah.
So you've got a very intense sort of 10-15 minutes. You know, it's in the style of a lot of you know, horror writing through the ages, which has predominantly been short story based.
Yes.
So people like M.R. James and, you know, Edgar Allan Poe and...
Because I suppose, could you say that that's because a lot of horror relies on a final exposition? Something has to... You've got to lead up to something and then it has to happen.
Mm-hmm.
And if it's a long form piece, it's like, well, you're just waiting and waiting and waiting for something to happen, or it happens repeatedly.
Yeah.
And then you're in a different genre altogether. For example, like the Guy N. Smith's Crabs books, where it's giant crabs, and it's a series of scenes where characters are introduced and then eaten repeatedly over a series of about 100 pages. It's good stuff.
Yeah, I think as well that a lot of those, you know, people like Lovecraft obviously got his start in... the sort of the amazing story type magazines.
Yeah.
So what they had to write had to be kind of quite short and episodic. And but I do think you're right. You know, it's hard to sustain. That's why horror is so much more successful as in the film genre, because you've essentially got to tell a story in 2 hours, and that's just enough time to. You know, obviously you've got exceptions to that. You've got Stephen King who.
Yeah.
But, yeah.
You can make a good idea last. Well, you can make an idea last for 3 books,
yeah.
And then still have it be turned into a really bad straight to TV.
Miniseries. Yeah, over 12 hours.
Yeah. Coil 3, episode
1. Ingredients for Hostess Ho Ho's: sugar, enriched bleached wheat flour. Flour, reduced iron, B vitamins, niacin, thiamine mononitrate, B1, riboflavin, B2, folic acid, water, partially hydrogenated oils, palm kernel, coconut, palm oil, cocoa processed with alkali, invert sugar, contains 2% or less of whey, polysorbate 60, leavenings, sodium acid pyrophosphate, baking soda, cornstarch, and monocalcium phosphate. Whole eggs, corn syrup, soy lecithin, egg yolk, whey protein concentrate, salt, soy flour, mono and diglycerides, natural and artificial flavor, sodium stearate, distilled monoglycerides, sorbic acid to retain freshness, soy protein isolate, calcium and sodium caseinate. Contains wheat, milk, egg and soy. Thank you.
So that's about all we've got time for. Kristen, thank you very much for your time. Thanks for coming on the show.
It's been an absolute pleasure. On your first show as well, I feel very honoured.
Well, you know, I need to test it out on
Some friendly guinea pig. In her hotel room.
Yeah.
You could have waited until I woke up, though. That would have been better.
Sorry, yeah. Well, you know, I waited till you got out of the shower, at least. So anyway, thanks ever so much, Kristen. Maybe we'll follow this up with some more chat later on when you come back to San Francisco the next time.
I would love that. Coil
3, episode 1. One thing I should probably cover is where the name for this podcast came from, The Coiled Spring. Well, it comes from my dog. My dog, Gordon, is not the most affectionate of animals. Obviously, he's really cute and very sweet and really smart, of course. But he's not the most affectionate, he's not the most snuggly, and if you do try and snuggle with him on the sofa or wherever, he's not into it at all, and he will escape at the first opportunity. In fact, in that regard, he's much like a coiled spring. If you take your hands off him, he's away, he jumps away. So that was that's the reason behind the title, but also, a coiled spring has a lot of potential energy bound up in it. And I like to think that this podcast has some potential. I've already got loads of great guests lined up. So over the next few episodes, I hope you join me on this new journey. The Coiled Spring was created, edited and presented by Matthew Petty and is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Non-Commercial Share-alike license. Music is by Kevin MacLeod at incompetech.com, and you can send suggestions, comments, requests and demands to feedback@coiledspring.org. Thanks for listening.